Today, I'm going to talk about politics by soundbite, and subtitle might be a look at the decline in the level of political discourse in our country. And in doing so, I don't want to suggest that the level of discourse was tremendously high and now it's just terrible. I will suggest it's terrible now. I don't know if it was ever that high or that good, and a lot of the negative cheap shots and so on have existed throughout history, only in different formats. 140 some years ago in Illinois U.S. Senate race, Lincoln, Abe Lincoln and Stephen Douglas had a series of debates around the state. And if you think back to what society was like in Illinois in those days, when you hear they had crowds of 4,000 or 5,000 people for debates, in central Illinois, where the biggest towns, they had 300 people. And the distance between towns, people had to go by horse or whatever. It could be 3, 4, 5 hours to get that many people into a place for one debate. And when you have 3, 4, 5 thousand people standing outside, no microphones, and the debates weren't 1 hour with an introduction from a moderator and wrapping up statements. They were 2, 3, 4 hour long debates. Now, I'm just impressed how their voices held for that long, to do that outdoors so without amplification you could have several thousand people here. But nevertheless, those are often held up as a model of what democracy should be. Good, fierce give and take of political debates and strong disagreements, and let the voters decide. Now we've come from that to 30-second attack sound bites, never done by candidates. You will never hear a TV spot in which candidate X is saying, my opponent is a slimy crook, or my opponent does this or that, or my opponent is anti-this. You always use surrogates, or a voiceover with an unidentified person doing it. And more commonly, you don't even have the campaigns doing it themselves. You have third parties doing it. The political parties of them, which this past year became outrageous in the amount of what they called independent expenditures, as if they had no coordination with the campaigns whatsoever. And independent groups, which spend sometimes $20,000 in a single race. And you get a number of these groups running a lot of TV spots. And without the candidate's knowledge and consent, often very vicious attacks on somebody else, and you realize that we've got some problems. In Minnesota, I know the past year, both parties, both national political parties paid for a lot of ads. I mean, massive ad campaigns to the tune of maybe $1 million a party. In the U.S. Senate race, our incumbent senator was, quote, a bigger spender than Ted Kennedy. And they used charts and so on. And one of them was a cartoon caricature of him, making him look ugly and ridiculing him. Many of them were that, but they were all funded by, in that case, the Republican Party. And likewise, Democratic Party had ads. You would have thought that Bob Dole's first name was Gingrich, because all of the Gingrich Dole did this. And there are some things where Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich certainly agree on things, and maybe a whole lot of them, but nevertheless, you would have thought his first name was Gingrich. And these 30-second ads do not provide a lot of information, and the fact that you see them day after day and night after night is not to provide any new information to the voters. It's just more drumming into their heads that so-and-so is not worthy of holding public office. The level of, I used an example from 140 years ago, Lincoln-Douglas debates, to now, it's gotten much worse in the last 20 years. Some political media expert or analyst did a survey, and from 20 years ago, the average soundbite, the average quote of a politician on network news was something like 44 seconds. Average quote nowadays is like 9 seconds. And there's not much you can say in 9 seconds that's going to inform people a lot. It's usually a very clever, sometimes positive thing, often attack on the other side, but it's how clever can you be in 9 seconds rather than how thoughtful your policy is. And along with that, we have the incredible power of image. I think it was Leslie Stahl, the CBS commentator, who in the 84 presidential election had done a very biting analysis of the Reagan record in his first term versus the rhetoric and the imagery and so on. And they did, it was an in-depth analysis on the 5:30, whatever time it is here, the evening news, CBS Evening News, about a 3-4 minute thing in which they had all the Reagan TV commercials, the flags, the sunsets, the Ronald and Nancy Reagan walking here, talking about how he cared about the environment and everything else. And then while they were showing these things, she was telling how hypocritical this was, how he had actually done this when he's talking about that. He did something and he was pro something, and the ad suggests he was anti that. The ad, the images all suggested it. And she did this thing, and it was a good piece of journalism. I think nobody was arguing with the accuracy of it at all, and she was ready for angry response from the Reagan campaign, and the response she got stunned her. She was dreading when she got a call from them that night after it aired. She was just didn't want to talk to the guy, but she took the call and, thank you, thank you, thank you. It was wonderful. And she thought, wonderful, did you hear what it said? Oh, it was wonderful. You gave us 3 minutes of showing all the pictures of how positive he was and how he loves families and motherhood and apple pie. Well, but what about the words? Oh, nobody hears the words. Our eyes have much more powerful things stick to us, what we see much more than we do. If I'm telling you that I really like something and doing this all the time, you're going to, it's confusing to you. It's very confusing, but what you tend to believe is, unless it's very obvious, the discord between that, if I say, yeah, you made a really good point there, that confuses you. But if I'm sort of not being directly saying that was a good point, I'm saying, must be the bus, I guess. If I'm saying something that's not directly contrasting or contradicting, you're going to believe what your eyes see, not what your ears hear. And so she thought that this was a powerful thing to show how hypocritical the campaign was. And his campaign people thought, wow, we got 3 minutes on national TV of our commercials running nonstop. And who cares what they say about it? You believe the images left is the one you see. And again, related to that, candidates learn from that. Reagan, they called the Teflon president, some have suggested. Clinton does similarly well in that way. And candidates have learned it's more important that you be seen, you have TV spots or news footage of you planting a tree, than voting in a way that will protect forests. It's not your environmental record that matters, it's the images that people see. And I still remember, and again, I'll leave Ronald Reagan in just a minute, but he was the Christian Coalition's family values candidate. Church, family, marriage and family, all those sorts of things were very positive. Like, well, first divorced president, back 20 years ago, it was a bigger deal maybe than it is now, but their daughter was born 6 months after they were married. That was a scandal in the Reagan, the Christian Coalition type of thing, yet those never came out. He was the good, again, the Christian candidate who believed in the Bible and spoke to all these conventions on it, yet they said he attended church 3 or 4 times a year. And I always thought the most compelling story about this was, I think it was Jim Baker's book about Reagan, talking about how once he and Nancy were, I believe, an Episcopal service where Nancy was getting bread before he did, and she watched the person next to her, and they had communion with intinction and dipped the bread in, and she accidentally dropped hers into the cup. And Ronald Reagan, who was watching her, dropped his into the cup too. And they talked about how the priest was just standing there looking at the president and first lady. wondering, what do I do about these two options? But this was the family values president, and yet even during the presidential years, his grandkids, one of his grandkids he had not seen by age 4, I believe. He had never met the grandkid. That's not, I mean, I know he's busy as president, though he may have been less busy than some others. Still, if you care about the grandkids, I don't know of any grandparent, anyone in this room or here, who, when they don't have a grandchild, they don't go out of their way to see that grandchild within weeks, if there's any way they can possibly afford to get a chance to see them. But nevertheless, the family values was what was portrayed, and it came across well. And I know after my gubernatorial campaign, we met with one woman who admitted she had voted for my opponent, and when she heard some of the things I stood for, she said, well, yeah, I wish I had known that. And she said, well, the thing you really got to get across next time, because, you know, you have to have a sense of humor in politics. And then she described me, contrasted me to some other candidate who really is a very wonderful guy, but doesn't have much of a sense of humor. Well, he was known as funny because he had some TV commercials that were really hilarious. They were very creative and clever, and we unfortunately did not. And so it is impressive how that can do it. Is imagery bad? No. There's nothing wrong with it. You can use images. It's a good way to educate. Billy is spending her week here telling stories. You tell stories because people connect to them. You use pictures, whether mental pictures or physical pictures. You use them because it helps provide information, and I think that's a very positive thing. The question becomes when you use stuff that is misleading or portraying a dishonest picture. When I gave the example before about a politician planting a tree in a TV spot and talking, you can always find something to show that you really care deeply about the environment. Even an anti-environmental candidate may be able to do that very effectively, but the interesting thing about how this works is if you vote against what might be called environmental legislation, you do something that corporate polluters may like, you are more likely to get campaign contributions for them, which makes you more likely to be able to afford the TV spots with you planting the trees, so you can come across more as the environmental candidate than the one who is on the opposite point of view, who may actually have a record that most people, if they look at the records, would say, that's the one who cares about the environment. They look at the TV spots, they get the other impression, that's the one who cares about the environment. And this lack of good, fair discourse extends even to debates. Lincoln and Douglas debates, they did not have tape recordings of them, so we can only surmise exactly what was said, but the news accounts suggested that there was, I'm sure, some name calling in it, and certainly harsh rhetoric. But they were give and take. They'd talk, and then the other one would argue back with them, and then they'd go back at them again. And here we have debates nowadays. I know in the last U.S. Senate campaign in Minnesota last year was one of the debates. All of the media analysis of it said neither candidate was answering any of the questions. Well, neither of them are stupid people. They know how to answer the questions. But you're told not to. You got to stay on point, is the directions we kept hearing. This is your theme, stay on message, stay on point. Don't answer the questions, they might get you into trouble, and certainly you don't get your message across by saying it. So you have candidates trying to use the same phrase over and over and over, same message over and over, 20 different ways to say it. No matter what the question is, you can give the same, you can tell what the answer is going to be. It's whatever the message for that debate was. And they're a series of little speeches. They're not true debates in many cases. And the only goals are, one, don't say something that's complicated or complex that could be used against you. And number two, you got to get that evening soundbite on the news. When you got 8 seconds, they can't do, when they have a 30-second story, so-and-so and so-and-so debated in this campaign, and so-and-so said this, and the other person said that, you've already gone beyond your 30 seconds. easily, you don't have time for that. So in effect, candidate X said, bang, in this clever shot, and that's what you get, and so you won the debate. Because how many people saw the debates? Very few. How many see the news? Many more. So the goal is to get the soundbite on the news. Well, what are the causes of, what's causing this happen? The most obvious one to me between 100 some years ago and present time is the amount of media that's hitting us. In why did 3,000-4,000 people travel, spend a whole day to go hear two candidates for one office debate? It was entertainment. I mean, I'm sure what we know about both of the candidates, they were entertaining characters. And what else is going on in central Illinois in the 1840s? It's, in a sense, where there's a lot of manual work, like at Holden Village, where so many things have to be done because you're not using as much machinery, you're trying to do things in a simpler way. In those days, you didn't have a choice. You'd spend not 40-hour work week, you'd be spending easily 80 hours just to provide the basic essentials to get on the table. So you didn't have a lot of opportunities. You didn't have the theater to go to. You didn't have anything else. So when is there a gathering? Well, political things were a good opportunity to get together. What do we have now? Up to 80 TV channels in some areas. You've got the internet and all sorts of books and movies that you can get at video store, and CDs that you can have games or video games. We have non-stop opportunities for that. You have radio, billboards, newspapers, junk mail. Our last campaign, our state senate campaign, and one of the reasons the guy lost was he didn't use his campaign very wisely. We had skywriting. He had an airplane bringing a banner behind, vote for my opponent. That was one of the dumbest campaign tactics, but the point is, everywhere you look, even in restroom stalls nowadays, there's media hitting somebody trying to get your attention and saying, do this, buy this, most often. Buy this political campaign as well. And candidates are competing with not one or two opportunities for news in Lincoln's day, but millions of messages that hit us everywhere we turn nowadays. And that's going to mean you have a lot less chance to get your message out. You got to work harder and harder and harder. You spend more and more money to get the same amount of information out. And the amount of information you get out isn't the thesis on some issue, it's the soundbite. The second cause of this is the media itself. Most of the networks a number of years ago didn't care if their news departments were losing money. That was part of the service they provide. Now every aspect of each of the networks must make money, and that includes the national news. And it's not, national news is not in the hand of journalists anymore in terms of TV. It's in terms of business people who are trying to turn a profit. And it's worse on local news than on national news because of sports and weather. But if you take a half hour broadcast and you cut out the 5 minutes for commercials and the sports and everything else, you do have, I think I mentioned yesterday, about 30 to seconds to 1 minute in the news for all government news, state, national, international, local, and campaigns thrown in on top of it. You don't have a lot of time. That doesn't mean that sometimes you're not going to have 3 minute focus on some aspect of this. But the average tends to be very brief, and it's not sustained, and it's one channel here and the other channels don't have anything on it. And I know so many times when there's some big campaign debate, you want to see some coverage on it. Oh, some deer got loose in the Twin Cities area and broke into some store windows, and that's the news. And it's disgusting as can be. You worked all this hard, and you had this big media shot, and some scandal happened, and so you lose to that. So there's less time for political news, and again, the sound bites do it. There's less public interest. Apathy is high. Cynicism is high. They don't trust anything to do with government. It's partly because of the negative stuff they hear from candidates. You don't want to vote for any of the candidates since you believe half the stuff. But there's a whole range of reasons that apathy is high, but the public, in many cases, just doesn't care. After last night's talk, Vern Fayata says, you know, your trouble is that you're like the teacher who needs to teach the students who refuse to come to class. And there's no good way you can do it. And people, well, we never have a chance. You don't tell us anything, so how can we do it? Well, you're not listening. And I got a wonderful letter from some woman this past year after the gubernatorial race in northern Minnesota who, she loved what I stood for, and this, and this, and this, and this. And she really wished, boy, I would have been a great governor. She would have voted for me, except I disagreed with her on a major issue. And the trouble was, I didn't disagree with her on that issue. She just didn't know and didn't bother to find out. And she was convinced I must have disagreed with her on the issue, so she had to vote against me. Well, whose fault is that? You know, mine because we didn't make that issue clear enough, or hers because maybe she wasn't trying hard enough to listen. And the voter does have to work. But there is very high apathy. And the combination of the lack of media attention and the high apathy means you do have to go to extreme lengths to get the attention. You gotta get the attention before they'll hear anything. And the old story about the guy who's trying to get the mule to haul his stuff, and he says, I tried this and tried carrots and tried this and can't get him to do it. I beg him, I tug on the thing and I do this and I do that. The guy says, no, all you need is a 2x4. 2x4, what for? Yeah, you beat him on the head with it. First you gotta get his attention. And I'm not suggesting that that's exactly what's happening in society, but it is much more. Look at talk radio, or hate radio as we may call it. Shock value is important. Who are the successful talk show hosts, the ones who keep growing new markets? Howard Stern is now in Minneapolis, and why? Because they're outrageous. You look at, and it's usually sick outrageous. When G. Gordon Liddy makes national, I think it's ABC network talk show, and they have an hour-long discussion of how you kill a federal agent. Don't shoot for the torso, they're always wearing body armor. This was about the year of the Waco incident. You don't shoot for the chest because they're wearing body armor, and he was telling people so you ought to shoot them in the head. And federal government officials, shoot them in the head. And now his callers were saying, no, that's dumb, you don't ever do that. Aim for the lower torso because you got the best chance of hitting them somewhere. And that's sick. And you think about 20 years ago, talk radio, I mean, may have been dumb. And maybe it was a bit too much on household tips or auto racing or whatever the topic was, but it wasn't vicious. But now, how do you make, who are the big figures that are the vicious, the nasty, the other ones? And campaigns learn very quickly, colorful attacks work best, shock value works, you gotta do that. And that goes along with the loss of the old standards. What's acceptable for media, what's acceptable for broadcast. Candidates would never do sicko stuff and vicious attacks. They always use somebody else, and people don't read those little disclaimers at the bottom. They don't see it as, I'm slamming my opponent. They see, my opponent's a bad guy. Look at these people, whoever they are, whoever's paying for the ads. We don't pay attention to that. They're saying that my opponent's a bad guy, and so I don't get any blame for it. My opponent gets all the blame for being a bad guy. Old standards are gone. You can be okay. Then more, next cause, more sophisticated campaigns. And I think one of the things they said that got Bill Clinton elected was the day an attack against him from George Bush came out, he was responding before the attack got all the way across the country in the airwaves. But one time they had, I think it was South Carolina governor, former South Carolina governor, attacking Clinton on, I don't know whether it was education or something else, it may have been Bush's education secretary, my memory's fading on that, but he was attacking Bill Clinton as a phony or whatever and bad on such and such policy. And Clinton campaign had, within 10 minutes of the quote on hitting the wire services, within 10 minutes of the Bush campaign saying that, Clinton had a response out there quoting the same former governor when he and Clinton were both governors, on him calling Bill Clinton one of the best governors in the nation and a truly bright, wonderful politician. And so before the attack had any sting whatsoever, they've got this, what a phony this guy is, attacking the same guy a couple years ago he was saying was wonderful. And that's sophisticated. And they track everything, and they track things not in terms of getting more information out, but in terms of the negative responses. I guess I've seen that happen in my own campaigns, not in terms of instantaneous response, but if you figure out, and I know who's doing it, it's actually government employees at the legislature doing it, but in 1992, a number of us got attacked by, they had the type of ad, so-and-so doesn't collect all this money and doesn't even bother to show up for work. So-and-so missed this many, 10% of all the roll call votes. Well, the person who got hit the hardest on this is probably, in most people, bipartisan agreement, was probably about the hardest working member of the Minnesota legislature. And the guy just happened to be on so many conference committees, and conference committees would often meet at the same time as floor sessions would. And because he was working so hard, he missed some votes. And you can argue that's not a good thing, but when you realize that probably 4/5 of the votes are unanimous votes, because they're, the disagreement by the time they get to the floor has been taken out of them, or they've been defeated, or some other thing. So again, about 4 out of 5 votes pass unanimously. And they tend to be technical things. Well, when you're in a conference committee and late in the session and there's a lot of votes happening quickly, is it worth interrupting the conference committee and having all the Senate members go run out to cast a meaningless vote that instead of being 60 votes or 62 votes or something? Is that a useful way to spend your time? Not necessarily, but when you have the ad saying, you didn't even bother to show up for work and you missed this many votes. The campaigns are becoming very sophisticated in the intelligence, in the dirt digging and so on. And it doesn't, again, if it was legitimate, so-and-so is voting against this when he's saying the opposite, that might be legitimate. I'm not going to argue about, against criticizing your opponent. It's just, it's sophisticated in a way that's being used for negative cheap shots. And then finally, the final cause, I'd suggest, is that we've got perhaps amoral campaign consultants. They don't care what's right or wrong. If it's legal, it's okay. I mean, that is their standard in many cases. I think it was Charles Colson, who in the Watergate years was quoted as saying he would have walked over his grandmother in order to help Richard Nixon win the presidency. And Charles Colson, having gone several conversions in a number of ways, has now said that that was wrong and he feels ashamed of it, but admits that, yeah, he would have walked over his grandmother to do this, and that was 20 years ago, and things have gotten worse, and they're very sophisticated consultants who will do anything. If it's legal, it's okay. Fairness doesn't matter. I mean, at one point we had, in my gubernatorial campaign, we had a consultant who stayed with us less than a week because of some serious disagreements. They had an ad already planned and was going to be attacking the governor for opposing a certain program. And it was a great sounding program. Trouble was, it wasn't a gubernatorial program. It was a study. It's called Kids Can't Wait. And it was a foundation study on indicators of child well-being and so on. And somebody had misheard this, and they had this clever spot already going to attack the guy for using that. And I said, there is no such thing as that. We'll check and we'll find out. The interest in accuracy and fairness is only, is there any legal liability if we get something factually wrong? And so they try and find a way you can word it that you can't legally attack, but you got to say it's unfair. So again, the too much media bombarding us, the poor media coverage, the lack of public interest, the old standards are gone that says certain things are too vicious and out of bounds, the more sophisticated campaign efforts, and the lack of any standards in terms of what campaigns feel they have to abide by. I think those are all the causes for why we have such bad discourse. Well, is what we have bad? I'll say yes, it's a bad situation. Not necessarily use of clever gimmicks or positive images. You can, as I said, use that as telling the stories, getting the message out. The trouble is the misleading stuff. And also, in addition to whether it's helping educate or not, it is very shallow or simplistic. It's not a good way to discuss public policy. Capital gains tax cuts is a good issue to debate, and there are big philosophical reasons. Is it a good way to stimulate investment, stimulate economic growth, or is it basically a tax cut that working people don't get, and that 99% of the benefits go to the richest handful of Americans? Not 99%, but a lot of the benefits are very heavily tilted to the wealthiest people in society. That's a good issue to debate. And both sides make some cases that are going to persuade some people and not others, and then the voters ought to decide. Well, how do you debate capital gains tax cut in sound bites? You can't. It's not a bumper sticker slogan. And it's not going to be the sound bite type of issue. So first of all, you take a lot of reasonable issues off the table. You can't debate those issues because they're too complicated. Second of all, when there is an issue that you can find a way to debate, the sound bite isn't necessarily the most rational or reasonable response, so you have to do that. So I'd say the shallow, simplistic policy options is one of the problems. Second one is that the voters don't get the information they need. In a democracy, it's not just letting the people decide and then here, okay, I want to know whether you want to vote for Ellen Johnson or Randy Smith for sheriff. And who are you going to vote for? Well, you'd like to know something about the candidate. Well, sorry, that's all you're going to know. That doesn't help you a lot. You can't have a very informed democracy if you have that, and yet our campaigns are designed not to provide a lot of useful substance. And certainly, as I said, a lot of voters are apathetic, but those who do want to know, those who do care, is there an easy way for them to find out? Not really. There are lots of things I can tell somebody if they want to spend some time on how they can get good information about campaigns and candidacies. But how much time is it worth for a campaign to aim for that small number of people when two-thirds of the public admit that they get a substantial portion of their electoral information from 30-second television commercials? I'm interested in the two-thirds who make up their mind that way, not the 1% who does it the other way. You know, my first campaign and gubernatorial campaign put out some detailed issue papers. And first campaign, I don't know, Connie, how many pages this thing was, but we reduced it real tiny, so it only took about 6 sheets. But it was quite lengthy, the issue papers. And we figured that the only person who read the whole thing was my opponent, trying to find out what dirt he could use. But it was useful because I carried summaries of the issue papers and a couple of different things around. When I was going door to door, I'd slip it in the brochure, and here's a brochure and an issue paper. Figuring if they want the photos, they get the clever photos and the nice sayings. And if they want the substance, there's some substance there. And it is true. And again, this is when you're going door to door, which you can do in a legislative district in Minnesota. In summer, when people are sitting out on their porch steps and so on, you hand somebody something and you tell them who you are, and they find out you're not a Jehovah's Witness, and that may be a relief to them. I came to this couple, this group of people. No, it is a relief. Usually, a group of 6 people sitting out in somebody's side yard, and I walked up to them. I'd been going down the street, And hi, I'm John Marty. I don't know if this is first time or second time. I'm Senator John Marty, or John Marty, candidate for Senate. And they all both got laughing. And I looked at you wrong, you know, because I looked very young the first time I ran. I always wore shirt sleeves and tie, sometimes jacket and cooler weather, but always certain tie. And they said, well, we're sorry, we don't mean to laugh. We were seeing you go up and down the street, and we thought you were a Jehovah's Witness. And because it was brief, they were, I'm sure, pleased. But after you'd walk away from houses, you'd see somebody who was sitting on the porch, and they'd still be reading it 10 houses later. You know, they'd still be reading every word. And how many that is, it's not a high percentage, but because you handed it to them and say, please read this, please do this. Well, if somebody cares enough to ask you that favor and it's only a couple pages, you do it. So I'm not going to, I will suggest, if you give the public some substance, they may take it. Not everyone, but some will take it. And you can legitimately be criticized for giving them fluff, even though that may be all they really seem to want. If you don't give them an option, it's partly your responsibility too. But you don't give the voters the information they need. And then finally, the vicious cheap shots, I don't think I have to explain why that is a negative thing. I mentioned how I was hit for missing votes and not bothering to show up for work. Those are great ads. I mean, everybody's seen them. The empty chair one and the public official's title on a nameplate in front of an empty chair and didn't bother to show up for work. And you can do it all kinds of ways to point that out. I had one, and for background on this, in the past 8 or 9 years ago, I made a decision I wasn't going to take any contributions over $100 from anyone, and not a penny from any lobbyists or from any political action committees or PACs, as they're called. That was a personal decision. I've been trying to pass laws that implement that in the state with mixed success on the passage of laws, but I've run 4 campaigns, 3 successful, 1 unsuccessful, using that kind of self-imposed limit without my opponents agreeing to abide by anything like that. Yet, in my 92 re-election campaign, my opponent had a brochure basically saying, John Marty is a friend of special interest PACs, and he supports special interest PACs and takes their money. I wasn't taking their money. He was. I mean, it was incredible. There was nothing dishonest about the thing. It was nothing factually inaccurate. Yes, I had taken some PAC money and everything else in my first campaign. I abided by the legal limits that everybody else did, including my opponent, who didn't abide by the voluntary spending limits, so took much more money than me. But I abided by the limits, and I ran a campaign under the rules. And in the 2 campaigns since then, I hadn't touched a penny of any of those sources. And my opponent was taking it, yet he accused me of being in favor of it and a friend of that, and he would oppose this. Well, that's cheap, but you don't always have the chance to respond. It's always the other thing about the cheap stuff is it always comes late on. Nowadays, with instantaneous response, it's harder to do the last minute cheap shots at the state and national things, but in the local races, you would be surprised how much of the stuff. I talked to one candidate who I first met out here at Holden Village, from Western Minnesota, ran for legislature, and a year later after I met him out here, I encouraged him to run, and he decided to do so, and he lost, and this last time he ran again, and he won narrowly, less than the majority in a 3-way race, and given every indication he should have won by a solid margin. Well, in those rural legislative districts, the campaigns have a spending of like $23,000 for those house races. In fairly small districts, and $23,000 is enough. Well, these independent expenditure groups, 2 of them came in, spent a total of well over $10,000 in his race. Not a person who contributed to those special interest groups came from anywhere near his district. One of them was from out of Minnesota, the other was from Twin Cities area. Not a penny came from his district. They were all telling people of his district who to vote for and who to vote against. And these groups spent more than half of his entire campaign, and he didn't see the first thing from them until like 8 or 9 days before the election. In these rural races, all you have is the weekly papers, and you have mailings, and there's no real easy way to respond to this, and by then you've spent much of your campaign budget, and they come and hammer you at the end with cheap stuff. But what are the consequences of this? Candidates learn they don't say anything controversial or even complicated. If you say, well, I'm going to work to reduce regressive property taxes, they're grossly unfair, and I'm going to do it by using more money from increased progressive income taxes, and I think that this is a fair shift to do, but that comes around in terms of, even the media is, you're going to increase income taxes to fund some property tax relief. And your opponent shortens it, and then the media will pick that up too, is you're going to increase income taxes. Well, how does that work? You stay away from that. You just say, I'm going to cut property taxes. Forget about how you're going to pay for it. You easily learn, don't say controversial or even complicated things. Don't be fully upfront. Talk about the good side, not the bad side. One opponent of mine had a brochure in which he talked 5 ways about how he was going to, he was proof that I was anti-environmental was because I had voted against funding some project that was pro-environment. And proof I was anti-education is I had voted against some expenditure that could show I was pro-education. I was anti 5 or 6 things because I didn't spend enough money, but boy did I love to tax a lot. And he was going to cut taxes and spend more for all these things. And again, candidates learn that that's a wise thing to do. You learn not to focus on the most important things, but the most newsworthy. You rely on images. You don't let the other side label you. You label them. And even the ads you run have to be made to draw news coverage. You do a cheap ad, and you make it so it's something so creative or so clever that the news media talks about it. So quickly, so we have more time for discussion, what do we do about it? How do we get out of this? Well, if I had a perfect answer, I'd be pushing it, and we wouldn't have the problem. The courts are not the answer. You can't say, what about libel or slander laws? You can't do that. There's nothing wrong about saying that, about planting a tree and creating this image that you're the environmentalist and you can use some vote, even if it's a pretty meaningless vote or you misrepresent what the vote means. You can't say it's false information. It certainly creates a false impression, but you can use that. Campaign compact. Maine and Minnesota have both had voluntary efforts to try and force candidates to abide by certain standards, generally in terms of not attacking the opponent. A very positive thing to try voluntary things. They won't work at all unless there's some significant backing up force in terms of public opinion and media. You have to pay the consequences if you don't. I read an analysis of Maine's effort in the last election. And they were so pleased with this, while all of the congressional and U.S. Senate candidates agreed to abide by it, partly because they had a say in it, they were telling all the positive things about it. And our biggest disappointment was in the one controversial race, the U.S. Senate, with the close race, the one close race. Everybody was abiding by it till near the end, it all broke out and they all did whatever they want. Well, the non-close races, why bother? I mean, why is a candidate going to break away from a pledge they made? If not, but the one close race they all did. So you have to have some heavy enforcement tool where the media is going to hammer, look at this candidate made this pledge, now look at their thing, look what they're doing. So you got to have some enforcement to it. Campaign finance rules, why not require debates? I think Washington State has voters' guides. They're put out by, I don't know, Secretary of State's office or something, and candidates have so and so much space to put in what they want to say on the issues. That's a great idea. That way, I mean, there are people who read those things. I know California's done that. Other states have too. Campaign finance rules are a big part of it. The media has a big responsibility, and they've been ducking it very much. They could be going out there. They can't do these things now. They now have in the Minnesota area, they have these ad watches. And the newspapers will put in a little thing, a little picture from a thing, and then a tiny type, 9-8 point typeface that says here's what the commercial, here's the text of the commercial, here's the audio, the visual, and here's our analysis of it. At least spend as much time talking about whether it's clever or not, and whether it's factually accurate or not. Not whether it's misleading, not whether it's vicious, not whether it's an attack. None of those things. And besides that, even if it was just lambasted him for a bad thing, how many people see the TV spot and how many read this boring little tiny box? That doesn't fill the gap. They have more obligation to do. And I'd say one of the things is, instead of interviews where you talk with a reporter 40 minutes, they use 20 seconds or 10 seconds, and they choose. I think when you have the radio opportunities and you have half-hour discussions or one-minute, two-minute interviews, they're verbatim, they're live. I love live interviews. They can't cut you. They have to take your whole thing, the good and the bad, together. And I think the media has an obligation for that. And the public should be demanding debates, issue papers, and they should be rewarding the candidates who don't do the attacks. Even if you might slightly prefer one candidate, you don't like either a whole lot, but you slightly prefer one to the other, you know, if that one starts just tearing this hide off the other one, maybe you got to figure out what they say about the other one, says something about themselves. You got to reward them, and certainly the candidates have some responsibility too. Again, it all ties together. We all have an obligation. And when candidates should have an obligation, a moral obligation, to debate, to be upfront, to be positive, candidates won't do it on their own because they know it doesn't work as well. And then that's when the public and the media can step in and force it. We had several offers from network TV stations in Twin Cities to have televised debates in our gubernatorial race. We only had one. Why? Because all the others know my opponent wasn't going to debate, so they said, fine. The other one said, well, if you don't show up, we're going to give him an hour of free airtime. Oh, I'll be there. It's not hard. It's not hard. If the TV station says, we're going to do it or else, or you show up or else, we'll do it anyway. They show up. And I think we all, working together, can work at changing it, but there's no easy way. And I did talk more than I was intending to, but I hope that's good enough to stimulate some discussion and questions or comments. Yes?
I'm just curious in your reaction, for people who aren't from, there's some Minnesotans here, but I'll just say that in Minnesota, senatorial race last time, Wellstone was up, and he was highly liberal and highly visible, and there was a lot of nasty campaigning against him, and he succeeded in being reelected over Pop. And a lot of people looked at that as a hopeful thing of the public getting fed up with negative campaigning, that people even that were kind of borderline maybe on totally agreeing with him just had had it. And there was a lot of commentary afterwards that maybe we're getting to the point that the negative ads aren't as effective. Do you have any reaction to that?
Yes. First of all, I'll fully agree with you that there are hopeful signs in that. Second of all, I'll agree that the public hates the negative stuff. But the reason I would say that the negative stuff didn't work against Wellstone was because it was very poorly done. They kept running the same stupid ads over and over and over, and they were very vicious ads. They were obviously vicious. The best campaign consultants in the Boschwitz campaign, the one who, well, I guess a lot of those were Republican National Committee ads that were running, not Boschwitz campaign. But they had some great vicious attack consultants doing this. I mean, great, I hate to use that word, but the so-called best in the business types in doing this, which is why it surprises me that they did so poorly in it, because they were a little bit over the edge, maybe not too much over. But the first time you might have seen them, they might be kind of funny, but you see them over and over. And, I mean, one of them was a caricature, and it was a terrible one. It made him look, Paul Wellstone's not the most handsome character in the world, it made him look bizarre, the cartoon caricature, and they had a little sign that said, liberal. And every time they'd say something, the little sign would flash up, this is liberal. And it would go faster and faster as the commercial goes on. And at a certain point, people begin to realize, you see something enough and you begin to start thinking a little more about that, and you think this. And I thought that if they had done those shots and they stopped and moved away from it and then, oh, our guy's a positive leader and so and so, I think they could have been far more effective. So I'd say the only disagreement I'd have about it being a sign of positive things is that most good media consultants now spend all their time trying to give the most vicious attacks that don't look like attacks at all. They try and be whatever. They try and look like they're not attacking when they are. Oh, the so-and-so is, oh, I've had so many people say, oh, John Marty's very well-intentioned, but he's naive or stupid or this. And, oh, that's the best way. Oh, I had so many colleagues, this year I had a bill on prescription drugs at the state agency that would administer the program to try and ensure some competition and enforce our laws a little better. The agency person who was responsible for for administering the program came to testify, and unlike 2 years ago, they said that this bill, their position was officially neutral. So he gets up there and says, well, our position on this bill is officially neutral. We do not have a position on it. However, I have, he said the word, grave concerns. And he used the word grave concerns 3 times in a 10-minute talk. I have grave concerns that this is going to do this. It's absolutely ridiculous because it's not going to work this way. And it has no chances. And boy, I wish this would work. But this is the most ridiculous thing in the world. And there's no chance of it working. But you know, we're neutral on this. But why doesn't he get getting opposed to the program? That's how the consultants tell you how to do it. And I mean, we all can understand why that works. If I just go out there and call my opponent a crook and a child molester and all kinds of negative things, people are going to say, ah, look at the name calling he's doing. You get other people to do it so it doesn't reflect on me, and then you get them to say it in such a way, oh, he's a very nice guy, but. Always those but phrases are things to watch out for. When they say so-and-so is a good person or nice person or means well or something, but I think that's where you have some problems. And again, in our campaign, we used the same one of the times in the campaign, and that was partly disgusted at him, one of the people who had done some of Wellstone's funny stuff. And they had all kinds of vicious stuff drawn up for our campaign, and I kept saying no. And so the end result was they ran some mush that was not, said nothing about me, it was all about my opponent. And they gave you, okay, here are your 3 choices, and 2 of them are absolutely unacceptable, the 3rd one's bad. And when this one woman told me how, you know, you gotta have a sense of humor in these things, I thought, yeah, that was the difference. Matter of fact, one of the ads from our campaign that was very catchy and it hurt our campaign was one that they had done, and again, I'm not proud of the ad because I think it was a terrible ad, and we spent good money on these terrible ads because they gave us worse choices, and by the time we could get out of it, I mean, we had a number of problems that caused that, but the ad was one that called That Darn Arnie about my opponent, the incumbent governor, and it had a caricature of him, and it was a very catchy tune that had been written for it, and you couldn't use harsher words than darn somebody, and in Minnesota, it's also a term of endearment, that darn so-and-so, and even though this guy is supposed to be a great media consultant, I think the ad cost us a lot of votes. I think it didn't cost us votes, it gained my opponent votes. If I ever was to do something like that again, I'd take the words and the music to that piece because, I mean, the music and the theme of that piece, because it was cleverly done, and just change it to That Darn Marty and run it yourself. How come we get all these cigar-chomping lobbyists saying, who took away all our clout, and it's That Darn Marty, and who did this, it's That Darn Marty. It could have been very positive and funny. You're poking fun at yourself. You do a caricature yourself. You do it that way. So I guess I think the ads have so much to do with it. We did a terrible job, which I guess I'm the one responsible for it. And do you ever have another chance? You never know, but I think you're right. You can see some positive hopes for things changing, because the public hates the negative stuff. The consultants are aware of that and they try and tone it down. One more question. I answered that one way too.
Is there a connection between the attack ad environment and the government by initiative, which is so popular in the West?
Yeah, I would suggest government by initiative is the same, is used so heavily because of the environment we're in that allows for the attack ads. I mean, I think it was 3-4 years ago there was an initiative in Washington State to undo everything the legislature had done related to tax policy the year before. I mean, talk about simplistic nuttiness. I don't know what happened. But what a rational way to run a government. We're going to just, it's again the simple just say no, throw the bums out, term limits, no new taxes. Anything that's that brief is sometimes, is one who's now learning to try and use simplistic things, because, you know, if that's all you have time to do, it may be worth saying some things just so they're positive things, appeal to the good, not the negative. But I think that's why initiatives tend to be popular, because in this climate you get the stuff to put them up and you have a chance to pass something. And certainly, like Maine passed a very positive initiative on campaign finance reform. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. Well, California, there have been a number of attempts to do that. So what happens to the side that doesn't like those things? They put up their own contrary initiatives, and they're funded with all the special interest money to kill off the other ones, and you live by confusion. And again, most issues, I don't think, are well resolved by yes or no responses, and initiatives are by nature a required yes or no. You can't amend it, say, well, I like a little more of this and a little less of this, which you can do in a legislative body. You can't do that on a ballot question. And so I think those are tied in with our climate of soundbite stuff, because they rely on that kind of governance, and that's, it fits in well. I don't know that one causes the other, but they both fit in well together.
Why do they have to spend so much money?
On campaigns?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it works. In our country, with the free speech, our First Amendment right to free speech, you can easily say free speech isn't free, it's very expensive. Mm-hmm. Of course, I can go and tell my political positions, I can go holler them over Railroad Creek and go up on the tailings and yell as loud as I want. And it's free. It really is free to do that, but nobody hears you. If I want to be on Seattle television night after night, 30 seconds a night to drum some message into people's heads, that costs money. And the courts have ruled that it's an unconstitutional infringement on free speech if we're going to say you can't run as many of those ads as you want. I think the courts are missing some other things. They're not misinterpreting First Amendment. They're misinterpreting what's happening here and what's encouraging debate. But I'm going to be talking about that a little bit next week, but basically, the more times you can run the TV spots with the trees and the positive images, the more you can persuade people that you're pro-environment, pro-consumer, pro-education, pro-taxpayer, pro-everything else. You run these ads and you persuade them that you're the good person and your opponent's the bad one, and it is expensive. And I think that's one of the reasons we campaign finance reform has got to be a major part of any attempt to increase the discourse. Give people, at the federal level you could do this, not states, you give them minimum 5-minute spots on TV, candidate has to talk to the camera, and you can do it. You take away all the flags and the bells and the whistles and the family and the dog and the sunsets, and just have the candidate speak to the camera. I mean, you give them, I don't care if you give them a half an hour or 5 minutes, they got to say something in 5 minutes. If they don't, it's going to sound funny. That was the one good thing about Ross Perot. Everything he said was just analysis and criticism, no solutions. He tried to portray it as solutions, but it was just criticism. But nevertheless, he's sitting there and, And Ross Perot is not the camera type of personality, but his charts, and he'd be pointing to this. He got quite a following. He got a fifth of the vote in the country with nothing other than a lot of money to put those things on TV. But if we give all candidates without a lot of money the chance to do that, you'll have a lot better discourse, even if it's just one candidate on the camera at a time, and the government could do some things to help that. With that, we are at an hour. I'm happy to stay around and talk for a few minutes, but for taping reasons, I'll call an end to it there. And again, happy to continue this.
Why I ask why it costs so much, because in Canada, the candidates are given the same time on the news so that they could present their case and what they are standing, you know, for. And that balances them equally. Whether you have money or not, you have the same opportunity. Why couldn't it be done here?
There are several things we have to look at that. One of which is we have to convince the courts that we have a real problem. And the argument I would make is the heaviest one, is that if it's a fundamental right that you can't take away from in any way, that everybody has the right to free speech, and political speech is the most important free speech, according to the courts. If we cannot take that away in any way, we got to say that that's more important than what we have a right for criminal defendants to have a right to legal counsel. And in this country, if you're accused of a crime, if you can't afford a lawyer, the courts give you a lawyer. They have to appoint a competent lawyer to defend you. If you don't like the lawyer, you can complain, get a different lawyer. You have that right, everybody, regardless of your income. Well, we say you have unlimited right to free speech. Unlimited. When you're not allowed to limit in any way, shape, or form. Unless you don't have money. Then you don't have free speech. And the courts are totally ignoring that equal protection issue. And the other one they're ignoring is the fact, and when you say both candidates have their right to get the message out, because you need the money to do the stuff, you have to appeal to the interests that give you the big money. And a U.S. Senate candidate who's trying to raise $6 million, which is not, I mean, states like Illinois and California, $6 million is, you can't do it for that much. Middle-sized states, I don't know what Washington states ones are, Minnesota's are now getting into the $4, $5, $6 million. To raise $6 million in a six-year U.S. Senate term, that is $1 million a year if you begin the day after your election raising money for 6 years down the road. $1 million a year, obviously, and divide that by, let's give you 2 weeks of vacation from it, 50 weeks of fundraising a year, you got to raise $20,000 every week for 6 years, 2 weeks off a year, in order to raise the minimum that a lot of states would call possible for a campaign. Well, how do you raise that money? You go ask these groups that have money to invest. And why are they investing money? Well, not because they necessarily like you or agree with you. I mean, you candidates tend to do things that they think will appeal to wealthier interests because of that. But the other thing, they tend not to speak up against things that do that. And then finally, these interest groups are willing to give money to any campaign that will listen to them. And why would an interest group give money to opposing candidates? I mean, that's dumb. I mean, I know people who give money only to Democrats of certain persuasions or Republicans who fit into this category. I know some who give to some Democrats and some Republicans. They call themselves independent voters. I don't know of anybody, any ordinary person who gives money to both the Democratic and the Republican Party, or who gives money to candidate X and candidate X's opponent, except for lobbyists and interest groups. Why do they do that? And wealthy individuals who have special interests of their own. Why do they do that? They want access. And they're not buying a vote, they are buying access. In other words, I don't know of many politicians, I don't know of any who would take an envelope full of cash under the table and then vote for something, which is a crime in every state. They don't realize the same impact happens when they take a big campaign contribution and then an issue that they might see as 49, 51% arguments for and against that it might change the 49 to be 51% because they're listening a little closer, or they're returning the phone calls for the wealthy contributor. Mm-hmm. So it's a big mess, and I'm going to spend a whole time next Monday or so talking about that.